So today I'm going to talk about the mystery of life, birth, death, and everything in between. A big topic, to say the least. Now, Mark Twain said something I thought was just right on. He said, you know, I wasn't here for trillions and trillions of years, and everything seemed okay. And then he showed up. And so from a Buddhist perspective, why did we show up? Well, according to Buddhism, there are three things necessary for human birth. Number one, dad. Number two, mom. Number three, karmic energy. So all the past lifetimes, all the karmic energy you've created blends and gives you life. Wow. I thought to myself, what the hell did I do to deserve this? In a way, I'm probably lucky I can't remember. But then we have all the things in between. Now, I was born in Iowa, and apparently there's a pretty good women's basketball team out there now. And then I was raised in Phoenix, Arizona, when it was cool to be in Phoenix, Arizona. And then I spent high school years in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which was good when I was in high school. And then, 1969, I found myself in LA. Man, how cool was that? We had hippies on Sunset Boulevard. We had long hair. We had political activism. It seemed like there was no holding us back. We had everything ahead of us, and it was just the perfect time to be in LA. Okay, but I turned 28. Now, that may not be significant to you, but if you read up on all the religious teachers, it seems 30 was a real important number in their life. Jesus, Buddha, you know, there's something about 30. And when I was younger than 30, the idea was don't trust anybody over 30, you know? And then Logan's Run came out, and you turned 30, and the gym started to blink. And you knew it was just a matter of time until they found you if you tried to run away. So I became depressed when I turned 28 because I knew once I turned 30, I'd be dead soon. So for a whole year, I thought to myself, what am I going to do? And I joined a gym. I thought, well, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die in good shape. And I was working out, and I was doing all sorts of exercises, and I was getting up early in the morning, and I really felt good. But then I realized there was another thing I needed to do. I needed to take care of my mind. It's not all body, though it seems that way sometimes. It's really all mind with the body. So I said, I need a religion so I can die well. People who don't have a religion don't die well. They want to go to a cryogenics lab and wait for the cure. So I bought a book by Houston Smith, The World Religions, and I read the whole book, and I read the chapter on Buddhism twice, and I said, I'm going to be a Buddhist. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know how to live or think as a Buddhist. And my father, the conservative person that he was, knew I was going to go right to hell. And so we didn't talk too much about religion after that. But I started to really find out about things that I hadn't even thought about. You know, and I was lucky to find the center where I now live, and I was lucky to find my first teacher who had English as a first language, LA guy, went to Japan, became ordained, came back, and he was the vice abbot at the center, the first center I went to. I thought to myself, how am I going to find a Buddhist center? Where do you look? And then it came to me, the Yellow Pages. So I looked in the phone book and I found IBMC, International Buddhist Meditation Center, had an ad in there. Free, come, we'll teach you how to meditate. So one rainy and cold night, I drove to Koreatown and parked my car when you could still find parking, and went into the Kuan Yin house. And there was a monk in there, and he said, okay, we're going to show you some of the basics real quick, and then we're going to go over to the Zendo house, and we're going to meditate for an hour and a half. And I thought to myself, I'll be dead tonight. I won't have to worry about 30. So we learned the basics, and then we went over, and then Shinzen Young came and led the meditation and gave the Dharma talk afterwards. Now, I didn't like the meditation part because it was cold. For some reason, they didn't turn on the heat. I figure that's probably a Zendo thing, you know, to make you strong. And then my knees hurt, and then my back hurt, and then my mind hurt because I'm thinking to myself, why the hell am I here? You know? But then Shinzen started to talk about stuff that really started to make sense to me in a really unusual way. One of the things I still remember is he pointed to the walls, and he said, all these walls are transparent. And I looked, and I looked. I said, they're not transparent. How long do you have to meditate to make them transparent? And then he went on to say, well, it's a concept. A wall is a concept. It's just like a door. They don't really exist because of the word. The word exists because of them. And so what you start to see is your whole reality is filled with a bunch of words creating images inside your head. And once you know that's a door, you can never see the reality of the door again. All you can see is a door. I mean, wow. So that's how it all started. And then I turned 30, and I didn't die, and I kept meditating, and I kept working out at the gym, and things were going pretty good. And then my teacher at that time, Dr. Ratnasara, said, why don't you become a monk? You know? I said, well, I don't know. I don't know if I'd feel good as a monk. Monks don't have sex, you know? And I'm not sure that's a good way to go. Yeah. So he said, well, what you could do is give it a try. You don't have to do it forever. You could give it a try and see if it's right for you. You really don't have much of a life anyway. So I said, okay, I'll give it a try. So I moved into the meditation center, and after a year, I became a postulant. I took 8 precepts, 8 vows, and then the next year, I took 10 vows, which is a novice monk. And then I kept that for 2 years, and then I took a lot of vows and became a fully ordained monk. And then after 5 years of apprenticeship, I got the red robe, which means I could start my own center or have my own students, and I didn't go in that direction. I went in the direction of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva is somebody that we heard about today in It's somebody who sees love and sees kindness and wants to dedicate their life to reducing the suffering of others. So I spent many years in community service, just being invited because I didn't charge, I was free. Can you help us out? Sure, I'll show up. And it was a wonderful journey. But there were still a lot of things I didn't understand. Even though I had been meditating and studying and listened to wise teachers, the thing I didn't really understand is sort of like the mystery of life. Why does all this stuff keep happening? And so I found something in early Buddhism, ancient Buddhism, that allowed me to understand it in a little deeper way. Number one, geology. If you understand geology, and what that's all about, you'll understand why a lot of stuff happens. For instance, earthquakes, New York. Who would have thought New York had an earthquake? Do you know? How about the solar eclipse that's coming? You know, as the earth turns and spins and the sun and the moon, they're like, man. So that's not like your karma. That's not like you're praying for something like this to happen. It's happening because you live on a planet with an atmosphere that goes around the sun. Okay, geology answers a lot of the mysteries of life. The next one is biology. Man, biology. You know, we're all sort of stuck with our biology. And some have good biologies and some have not so good biologies. And if I were to take off my hat, you would notice that I have the same hairline as my father did. Non-existent. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, Dad, thanks a lot. But of course, his dad had the same hairline, and on it goes. And then some people are tall, and some people aren't so tall, and some people have blue eyes and brown eyes. And you sort of look at biology as answering a lot of those questions that you had. And from a religious perspective, it's some of it has to do with the karma that put us there. You know, and so you go, okay, so now I've got geology and I've got biology. Now the next thing that answers a lot of questions is our moral aspect, the karma. Now the karma means that what we say, what we do, and what we think, they all have a consequence. So we have karma, we have cause, and then we have vipaka, early Buddhist word, which means consequence, cause and consequence. And some of it's pretty easy to see, some of it's pretty easy to understand. This takes the place of a divine lawgiver in Buddhism. So we don't have a divine lawgiver that says this is right and this is wrong. What we have is karma. We have more suffering and we have less suffering. So if you're skillful, you're suffering less. If you're unskillful, you're suffering more. It's a pretty easy way to determine how skillful you are in the moment, in the day, in the month, in the year, in your life. Okay, and one of the things that just blew my mind was that some of the stuff we do in this lifetime doesn't create a consequence until next lifetime or lifetimes later. So it's hard to determine why you're going through what you're going through if you're just using this one lifetime. And another thing that just blows my mind is what connects the cause and the consequence? What's the connective tissue? How does it go from cause to consequence? And the Buddha said you won't figure that out. That's really complicated. But when you achieve nirvana, then you'll know. And I'm thinking, okay. So the Buddha was like the best teacher that you could ever have because he could look at you and see what you did in the past to get here in the present and what you need to do to have a good future. He could see those connections. I thought, man, that is so cool. To be able to see all those connections and to see how things are interrelated and interdependent. Alan Lightman, an author and a physicist, said, after having a religious experience in a boat on the lake, looking at the sky, he came to the conclusion, rightly so, that all things are connected. All things are connected. Do you know how radical that is? That means everything that's happening in the east or the west or the north or the south, there's some part of it that's connected. You know? And if you drop a glass of water in Los Angeles, there's a ripple effect that goes all over the world that you're not aware of. You know, that's what I sort of like about Buddhism. It gives you a lot of stuff to think about. And then ultimately, it says to you, it doesn't matter what you think. And don't believe everything you think. Because that's not it. Thinking is not it. Okay, now we come to the Dharma, which is a word that's translated in many different ways. But in this context, the Dharma would be the teachings of the Buddha or the ultimate truth. Okay. Now, the Buddha, in his 45 years of teaching, only taught two things. You would think he would have gotten bored. Two things. But every audience was the first audience. And everybody in that audience heard it differently. They say that no two people can read the same book. And no two people can hear the same talk. And no two people can see the same movie. We're all individuals, yet we're all connected. So the Buddhists taught about why we suffer and how to end the suffering. So the Dharma for us as a Buddhist is understanding why we suffer. And that takes a lot of time to read and think and practice and be able to see the suffering itself. Because suffering has no form, and it has no color, and it has no taste. Suffering doesn't exist out there. Suffering only exists in here, in the mind. Suffering is mind-made. And ultimately, suffering happens because we have desire and craving and thirst, and we have attachment, and we have aversion, and we have all these things that drive us to try and make a perfect present moment. If only this, if only that, this would be the perfect day. But there's always one piece missing, and it never becomes the perfect day. And even if it could become the perfect day, it would only last a moment, because everything is in a constant state of flux and change. Man, is that a big deal? You know, every human in the being, perhaps not the enlightened ones, but every other person, they're suffering. They're unsatisfied. They know it could be better. And yet somehow we can't figure out how to do it because there are 999 reasons why stuff happens. And the extra reason is because of us. But we're only one of the contributing factors. We're the only one. So we have those 999 other things we try to manipulate and move and push and grasp and cling to, and we never succeed. So life can be sort of a bummer for sometimes. It can be really happy other times. It can be so satisfying at other times. And then finally, the last key to this model is the mind. Some schools of Buddhism say the whole world is mind-made. We never exist in the world the way it really is. We exist in the world the way we think it is. And from early childhood, man, they got us in school. I hated school. I couldn't figure out why they wanted me to go to school. Nobody ever told me why they wanted me to go to school, besides saying, you have to. And I'm going, why do I have to? I can remember kindergarten, and my mom drove up to this big brick building with windows and said, I'm going to leave you here, and you go inside, and that will be your kindergarten class. But Mom, I don't know anybody in there. I don't know anything. I want to stay with you. And she, no, you can't. You have to go to school. And there I was with a bunch of strangers my age and older. And I'm thinking to myself, why am I here with all these people I don't know? And of course, that's the beginning of socialization. So we can start to hang out with other people and see their pluses and minuses you know, and have friends and enemies, and all the things that we have when we hang out with a bunch of other people. Okay, so, you know, with grade school, high school, you know, and it was just not a fun, exciting time for me. Though I did learn a few things. But basically, I like to consider myself self-taught. I would go with what interested me. I would go to the library or the bookstore and I wonder about this, you know, and I'd pick a book and I'd read it. And now, of course, we've got Google in 1,000 different websites. If we're curious about anything at all, we can find the answer in just minutes. You know, it's really interesting to be able to have that kind of control over what you know. But do they control us? Is it our control or is it their control? Do they want us to see the way they see it? Is there an ulterior motive? Do they want us to work harder and buy more stuff because that makes the world such a better place? Well, you know, that's the 60s talking. And you sort of look at that stuff and you go, yeah, okay. Okay, so what do I need to do as I age towards my demise? Ram Dass hit it right on the head. Ram Dass said, in the beginning of our life, we're in somebody training. We're training to be somebody. And towards the end of our life, we're training to be nobody. We're letting go of somebody. And why is it good to be nobody at the end of your life? Because nobody dies well. Ooh. So I don't have a lot of stuff to let go of at the end. Then it's time to let go of my attachments and my books and my guitar and all those things that meant so much to me while I was alive that mean nothing to me as I'm dying and eventually crossing over, according to Buddhism, into the next lifetime. And sometimes it makes so much sense because, you know, so not everybody dies well. And sometimes there's a lot of suffering that goes on, a lot of pain that goes on, and a lot of regret that goes on because they didn't live the life they wanted to live. And so it must be easier, if that's the case, to let go of this lifetime if you have in mind that there is another existence after this. Heaven. Nirvana. We have 33 heavens and 33 hells, so we have like a lot of places to go. You know? And I bet they're all better than Los Angeles. So, but then we've got this Nirvana thing, which is the final goal of all Buddhists. No matter what school of Buddhism, it's the final goal. And they say about Nirvana, if you achieve it while you're alive, you end your karma, you end your suffering, and you end all future rebirths. Because remember, in order for me to show up, I had to have karma and a mom and a dad. So if you take away that karma, then I can't show up again, ever. So then I thought to myself, well, what does that mean? What would Nirvana feel like? Would it be anything that I have experienced in this lifetime? And it wouldn't. There would be nothing I could relate to because it's unboring. Pardon me. It's not boring. It's unborn and it's undying. So everything that exists on this planet Earth had a beginning. Nirvana has no beginning. Nirvana has no end. So would I have form in Nirvana? I don't know. Would I have existence in Nirvana? Not that I could relate to. If somebody told me about Nirvana, would I understand what the heck they're talking about? Probably not. Think of a turtle and a fish. And the turtle is talking to the fish and explaining what it's like to be out of the water. But the fish never get to leave the water. So they have no way of understanding what's being said. And the turtle would probably get frustrated and just walk away. And those fools, they don't know what they're missing. And he'd be right. The turtle would be right, because they don't know what they're missing. They have a pond or a lake or an ocean, and that's their existence. And we have this existence. And we had a beginning, and we had a middle, and we had an end. So could we understand our existence without a beginning? Could we understand our existence without an end? Probably not. So if a lot of food for thought, I thought to myself. This is what I was expecting about Buddhism and having a religion. That they wouldn't give you any darn answers that you could really understand. It's more like metaphors and poetry. And, you know, and you're just going, oh, man, what? Okay, I almost got it. I almost got it. But then I'm thinking about intuition. Okay? Now, I meditated for like 20, 25, 30 years before my intuition came back. Because my intuition atrophied because my intellect grew. And the stronger my intellect was, the less intuition I had. And now, after meditating, I have more intuition. And so somebody says, well, what is it? What is that intuition, Kusala? I said, well, it's a feeling. It's a feeling. They say, well, what kind of feeling? I don't know what kind of feeling. It's just sort of a feeling. It happens every day. Wow, how does it happen every day? Well, every morning, early in the morning, even before the sun comes up, I wake up and open my computer, and I go to Facebook, and I begin to post. And what I like to do is I like to post pictures, and then I like to post little things that people say that I find on the internet. Like, they have so many sites now. You can find such good thoughts at these places. You know, it's just, okay, so now I've got this picture, and now I've got this little thing I'm going to put on top of it to sort of make the picture even more understandable. And then, how do I know I've got the right combination? Because I feel it. It's not intellectual, but I feel it. It feels right. Okay, cool. And then I post it. And then a few minutes later, it might be right for a lot of people, and it might be wrong for others. But that's how I experience my intuition every day. And now more and more things are happening. I look at the cats that I feed every day, and I can sort of tell different things about them, not at an intellectual level, but an intuitive level. And one of the things you can't do when you feed cats is talk to them. It confuses them. They're saying, what the hell is this guy saying? So you do it all in silence. And in silence is where you find your intuition. It doesn't happen because you're talking about it or because you're thinking about it. It happens because you're not talking and thinking about it. So how cool is that? How many times in this lifetime of mine have I rediscovered myself? Have I understood myself to be different than I thought I was? More than I can count. That every stage of life, whether it be a day, a moment, a year, a decade, requires me to be somebody new. I have to keep adjusting because the whole world is changing. You know, I posted something about David Bowie. The next time you're sad, it said, think of how remarkable it was that you lived at the same time David Bowie lived. You can't be sad about that. That's a miracle. Of all the thousands of years humans have been on this earth, there's only been one David Bowie and only one you. And somehow you made it together. Wow. So life is a trip. Life is a journey. Life is wonderful. Life is not about thinking it. Life is about doing it. Just do it. Thank you for listening.